Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. For those of you who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a key role in helping human beings rise to meet our current challenges to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. And I've now held over 60 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. Once you've registered at BeyondAwakeningSeries.com, they're all available for free download at BeyondAwakeningSeries.com/blog. This morning, I'm joined by Carter Phipps, and he and I will be continuing that discussion in a conversation entitled Evolutionaries, Who, Why, How, and You. The way this will work is that I'll introduce Carter and we'll dialogue for about an hour. Then I'll make some announcements and we'll spend another half an hour or so taking your questions, and we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Carter Phipps is an author, journalist, and a leading voice in the emerging field of evolutionary spirituality. For the past decade, as executive editor of Enlightened Next magazine, many of you are aware that he's really been at the forefront of contemporary spiritual, philosophical, and cultural discourse. And his writings have played a key role in making important new thinking available to many of us and a broader audience than otherwise. His areas of interest and expertise range from metaphysics to politics to science and technology. So his writings combine the careful rigor of investigative journalism and a passionate personal concern for the development of human culture. In 2009, his feature article, A Theologian of Renewal, was awarded a Gold Award for Editorial Excellence from Folio, the leading magazine industry awards. And he regularly presents at conferences. He's spoken at Brown University, JFK University, the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology. He participates in leadership gatherings, including Deepak Chopra's Evolutionary Leaders Forum, the invitation-only Assembly of Leaders prior to the 2004 Parliament of World's Religions, and the 2008 Edinburgh Festival of Spirituality and Peace. He's appeared on BBC Radio's Supporting Reporting Religion, New Dimensions Radio. He's a regular guest on Deepak Chopra's Wellness Radio on Sirius Satellite. And he's also a board member at Enlightened Next and the Open Future Institute. Most of all, he is the author of the important newly released book from HarperCollins, Evolutionaries, Unlocking the Spiritual and Cultural Potential of Science's Greatest Idea. And it was just released a week ago. Now, something that I especially appreciate about Carter is his combination of intelligence and humanity. He's an authentic, very intelligent, but also humble and vulnerable human being, a sincere spiritual practitioner. He's a senior student of spiritual teacher Andrew Cohen. And yet he's very insightful and a very clear and original critical thinker in his own right. So I recently read his book, Evolutionaries, cover to cover, with tremendous pleasure, and I highly recommend it. It makes an enormous contribution to illuminating and defining the implications of an evolutionary worldview. So welcome, Carter. I'm really delighted to have you on the program this morning.
Hello, Terry. Nice to be here on Beyond Awakening. Great to be part of this.
Well, terrific. You know, your book is a really rich and detailed tour of a whole series of insights. It's an educational tour, in a sense. We see intellectual history, insights, discoveries, epiphanies, the whole process through which you and I and many people have awakened and are awakening now to an integral and evolutionary worldview. And it would really probably set the stage for our conversation if you'd try to offer us a broad summary of what that really is, with an emphasis on a couple of key ideas, the ones that you refer to as breaking the spell of solidity and the Flintstones fallacy.
Sure, absolutely, Terry. Yeah, I mean, the book itself is, as you say, it's a very kind of broad in some sense, an overview survey, kind of trying to capture a new movement in culture. And the movement has been building steam slowly in the background over the last, you know, really few decades, and really over the last couple hundred years. But it's the ways in which people are using the idea of evolution in all kinds of ways to re-examine the way we think about human life and culture at this point in our, you know, in human cultural history. And so the book is really an attempt to kind of capture many of the, of both the people, and I profile a number of people in the book, but also the ideas that are kind of critical to this new movement. And, you know, I track a lot of different ideas through the book, but as you mentioned, there's a few that are sort of essential that kind of jump out at you and I really highlight. And the first one is the is just kind of what I feel is the foundational idea of an evolutionary view of the world, you know. And by evolution, I mean more than what Darwin was talking about with biology. I'm talking about the sense that we are moving forward and part of this developmental process, and not just biologically, not just species, biological species, but also cosmologically and also culturally. So this fundamental idea that we are moving forward, that we are part of this kind of process of development that's been going on for, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, millions and even billions of years, is quite a revelation that's happening, and it's happening in all different fields, and I kind of take the reader through different fields where this is happening. And I kind of talk about the way we usually think about the world. We think about the world often in very static ways. We think about things as being very, we just tend, it's part of the way our brains are built and part of the way our minds work. We tend to think about things in very fixed ways. We tend to think about human culture as being kind of fixed and unchanging. Human psychology is being kind of fixed and unchanging. You know, human spirituality in some sense is being sort of fixed and unchanging. We tend to think so in so many ways about things as being relatively static, and we kind of think in this with this kind of air of stasis about how we see the world. And so I call this switch, you know, breaking the spell of solidity. You know, breaking this idea that we live in this world of stasis, and recognizing in a much deeper way that we don't live in a world of stasis. We live in this world where everything is in this process of becoming, where we're moving individually, culturally, biologically, psychologically, cosmologically, in all these different fields. You can see we are breaking the spell of solidity and realizing this deeper truth about the nature of reality itself, that we are moving
now this is kind of got two levels, I think, Carter, isn't it? Like, on the one hand, it's sort of like Buckminster Fuller's famous line, I seem to be a verb.
Perfect,
but
exactly.
On another level, it's got to do with seeing with deep time eyes. That is,
yes,
recognizing that the endless changes that don't lead anywhere, that are the wheel of birth and death, and, you know, that we have to kind of, in a spiritual way, outgrow embeddedness in, actually masks something much bigger and longer term.
Exactly.
You know, Carter, I got a Skype from Brad about your son. If there's anything you can do to speak loud, more loudly, or speak into the mic a little bit more, I think your voice is not quite as loud.
Okay.
I understand. So, yeah, as you respond, please be as loud as you can. Thanks.
Okay, we'll do. So I think that this is a great issue, and I think in some sense one way to look at this is that when, you know, historically, in terms of the, if you look at the mystical insight, that realization that there's a deeper truth to the nature of reality, there's a deeper oneness, a deeper truth underlying the surface things we see of the nature of this world, the nature of reality. In some sense, when we break through that and realize this deeper mystical dimension of reality, we also break a certain spell. We see through this, you know, the illusion of kind of just of changing forms and appearances, and we see into this deeper reality. So I think there's an analogy to be drawn there between breaking the spell of solidity in a sense of a deep penetration into a mystical truth, and breaking the spell of solidity in what I'm talking about, which is we don't just realize that we're part of this ever-changing world that's constantly in flux and moving through different forms and features and appearances, but we realize that world has another dimension to it. That world is not just changing, it's actually moving forward. It's actually developing. It's actually evolving. And that's the revelation that really is so transformative at this time. It's not just changing from this to that. It is evolving. And that's the powerful breakthrough of this time in history.
Beautiful. So that leads also, though, not just to a recognition that what we see is always a changing process that is not just changing in the fast-moving terms that we're able to obviously observe, but in terms of deep and powerful trends that are a kind of meta-change that is the evolutionary process. It also helps us see something about how our interiors are changing, and that's, I think,
exactly
what you're pointing to with this Flintstones fallacy idea.
Exactly. The Flintstones fallacy, it's one of those terms you wish you would have made up, but unfortunately it's not my term. It was a term by a Dutch theorist, Jan Sleutels, I believe was his name. And I first heard it about 5 or 6 years ago, and it's a great term that really captures the way in which the spell of solidity tends to dominate our consciousness when we think about human history. And the Flintstones fallacy means that we tend to see human consciousness as relatively unchanging over the course of human cultural history. We tend to think of, that we were more or less just like the Flintstones, where they're essentially the same kind of consciousness that we have now, just different technology. That's the Flintstones fallacy. But what we're realizing and what we're beginning to realize is that, no, the nature of our interiors are also not fixed and static, that human nature, as much as sometimes human nature can seem to be unchanging and the same as it ever was, you hear things like that. Actually, we are also, in the interior of ourselves, in the interiors of culture, part of this evolving process, and that human nature and human consciousness and human culture has really been developing and changing over the last, hundreds of years, thousands of years, and dramatically over the last 10,000 and 50,000 years. And in the book, I really try to kind of capture and I explore some of these theorists who really were on to this insight. Theorists like Jean Gebser, who some people will recognize, who, had this, really tried to kind of peer back into human history and get a sense of what consciousness was like 3 or 4,000 years ago. And when you appreciate that, when you see how consciousness has so dramatically and powerfully evolved from what it was 2,000 years, 3,000 years, 4,000 years, 5,000 years ago, you see the human drama of emergence in a new way. And you appreciate how those who have come before us have pioneered so much and really, steered the way forward in human evolution. And it makes you realize how far we've come. And then you see the problems that we're facing as a society in light of how far we've come. And it gives you the inspiration to actually respond to those problems. And there are tremendous problems we need to respond to in the world, but it gives you a different context and a different kind of inspiration for dealing with those problems when you recognize how much humans have this kind of struggle of evolution and emergence that has been this kind of drama of human history and this powerful, exciting drama at that. So, and then you just say, wow, we have a chance to participate in that drama and right now, and to really take that evolutionary process, a little bit further in our own time. And now, for the first time, we can do that in a way that's conscious. We can recognize, not only can we move human history forward a bit in time, in our own time, but we can do it in such a way where we become conscious of this whole process. And so our capacity to impact the process, because we're aware of it as never before, is increased. And that is the opportunity of this moment in history.
Yes, this is clearly what inspires me, so much. And I think this sense of possibility is so galvanizing once it really strikes, once you realize that how we are being and what we are doing is part of this great story, and that it ends up being the, you know, we are enacting that which will be the legacy of those who come beyond us. That just
right.
as you were saying, we are only able to be how we are and awake in the ways that we are because of those who preceded us, and we're the continuation of that great story. We are also writing the next chapter of it. And in fact, for good or ill, when you say we have a chance to, you know, I thought to say,
yes.
Well, inevitably we are doing it, whether we, you know, we're writing an unconscious chapter in it or a conscious one. We're, you know, one that's part of this positive evolution or part of the stress and regression that are also inevitably part of the way things work their way out. Therefore, everything we do matters, positively and negatively, huh?
Yes. That's right, and that's part of the, I mean, the great evolutionary imperative in some sense is that we are contributing, you know, we are in some form or other, and we have this opportunity to contribute in a kind of awareness and consciousness that we've never had, but it means starting to realize and starting to cognize human development differently. And when we start to wrap our hearts and minds around this truth and these truths and this set of truths, it does affect our worldview. It affects, and then it's not, you know, it is an intellectual matter, but it's deeper than that because it affects the way you, when you start to have this kind of view and this kind of perspective, it contextualizes your own life differently and contextualizes your own actions differently and contextualizes your own response, your own heart's response to the issues that we're all dealing with individually and collectively in our shared culture in different ways. It actually will change your responses and change the, you know, hopefully the power of those responses and the impact of those responses. And that's, you know, again, that's the opportunity, but we have to take advantage of it, you know, otherwise we'll continue to drift, you know, in this more or less kind of unconscious evolution. And the problem with unconscious evolution is you have a lot, you know, it's just like unconscious driving, you know. If you're going forward and you're driving unconsciously, you slam into one side of the wall and you slam into the other side and you slam into the other side. You know, you may go forward ultimately, but you have a lot of wrecks in the meantime. You know, it's a painful process. But if you start to wake up, you can kind of put your hands on the steering wheel and you can keep from depending on just slamming the one side of the wall and the other side of the wall to provide the forward angle, and so you can actually start to steer, and that's the great opportunity. But you know, the Flintstones fallacy is a very powerful fallacy in our culture right now, and we have to work to break that in ourselves and in our culture.
Yeah, I think many very sophisticated people would dispute that assertion that this, you know, there are. I was in conversation with one of the people who's a guest on this program, a dear friend, who was a thought leader, you know, Rick Hansen, who wrote Buddha's Brain, and was pointing out that Buddha's interiors were just, you know, Gautama Buddha's interiors were just much simpler because he lived in a simpler society, and that wasn't obvious to Rick. You know, he didn't
yeah.
get that. There are sophisticated, well-read people who are very informed who don't see the significance of the evolution of interiors, and I think your book might be important in some particular ways. That is, I think you may be adding something to the clarity of the argument for the importance of an evolutionary perspective in the way that you have, I think in a detailed fashion in your book, pointed out the elements that argue more rigorously against sophisticated resistance to some of the key aspects of this epiphany that the
right.
evolutionary worldview represents. And I'd appreciate you, you know, imagining a skeptic here. I can't very well pretend to be the devil's advocate on this point because
yeah.
I'm so out as an evolutionary myself. But you know, okay, let's speak to that skepticism. Can you, in a very simple and summary way that you think has authority, really rebut it?
Well, I think there's a few things to speak to here, and I agree this is a challenging idea, it's a challenging idea because for one, it's an idea that's been abused by evolutionists in the past. You know, where we decide that we're the pinnacle of evolution and all other human cultures are sort of these kind of primitives. But it's one of the things that's important is you start to see that the nature of emergence over the last 10,000 years is much more complex than that. It's very rich, and it's not just diminishing earlier cultures or earlier peoples or saying they were lesser. Quite the opposite. You're saying they were in this process of cultural evolution and development, and we can appreciate the extraordinary kind of gains that they made and the insights they had and how they took the ball a little bit further in history, and we should feel the responsibility to do the same with our own capacities. You know, so it certainly speaks to the enlargement and deepening of human interiors over time. And the changing of human interiors over time. And so we can look back and see, wow, and it's a very rich thing when you actually begin to accept this idea. The history of human development becomes richer and more fascinating in my mind. It doesn't diminish your sense of what history is or what earlier expressions of human consciousness is. And so And of course, if you see things in also the very material, you know, biologically oriented, genetically oriented way, if that's the only lens through which you see evolution and the evolutionary process, then it can kind of rigidify and put sort of in a straitjacket the way you see these issues, you know, and so it helps when you start to see that the interior world is its own dimension of evolving forms and features and structures, and that has its own, you know, ontological reality to it. When you see that, it kind of liberates this sense that everything has to be kind of mediated through the straitjacket of genetic development and biological development. And you get out of that kind of straitjacket, and it gives you a much richer, more flexible, more powerful way to understand the evolution of peoples and cultures. And I think we have to start to break out of, and that's the advantage of breaking out of this kind of narrow biological view of evolution. It gives you a much richer lens. And so I know that there's some complex arguments in here to really have, and in order to convince skeptics, I almost feel like you need to, you know, there's about 6 or 7 or 8 ideas you really need to walk through, and they're all, many of them are new ideas, and they all kind of work together. And, you know, one section of my book, I kind of walk the reader through like 7 or 8 ideas and kind of show how they work together to create this new way of seeing the evolution of consciousness and culture. And if you leave out 3 or 4 of those ideas, then the idea kind of breaks down and we get into much more rigid versions of it like we had in the 19th century. But when you do have all those ideas, you start to appreciate the richness of it. And then some of the fears associated with just kind of like we're going to see ourselves as the pinnacle of history and everyone else is barbarians. Some of those fears associated with evolution really, really begin to be diminished.
And, you know, I imagine the listeners are saying, okay, so tell us what those 7 or 8 ideas are. Can you just rattle them off? And I'm not sure that you can do justice to them, but you might be able to at least recite the headlines of some of the key ideas that interchange. I know we want to get on to talking about evolutionary spirituality and activism and some other themes, but I'd love to hear as much as you can say about that.
Well, certainly, and I certainly can, and you know, I won't be able to do them justice in a very brief period of time. Unfortunately, some of these ideas do take a little bit of unpacking and discussion, but you know, the nature of how worldviews develop. You know, in the book I talk about an evolutionary worldview, and I really talk about the nature of how worldviews form and these complex systems of culture that kind of form inside our minds, but in our shared mind. You know, that's one of the ideas, and the way agreements and work to form worldviews. And then I talk about, you know, that one of the recognitions of you know, that comes out of integral philosophy is this idea that we don't just have subjective interiors or the objective world out there. It's not just I and it. There's also this we dimension, this intersubjective dimension, and that also it has its own reality to it. And when you start to recognize this shared we space that also has its own reality and that structures and forms and features are evolving in that dimension as well as in the objective world and as well as in the subjective world, it kind of, it liberates everything from being in nature or just being in the self. And you start to see, oh, human culture is happening in that dimension, and it changes the way we see evolution in important ways. And then you start to recognize also that, you know, as the Don Beck and his work with spiral dynamics has been so good at pointing out, that human evolution does not just happen in this linear line. You know, there is this dynamic and dialectic of progress and pathology where we may take great leaps forward in our individual and cultural evolution, but those great leaps forward create new problems. They create, you know, difficult new problems to deal with. So just because so many things seem so bad in certain ways today, you know, a number of other things are so many things are better than they've ever been. And that's part of the dialectic and dynamic of evolution. That's not unexpected or confusing. That's actually part of the dynamic of evolution. And, you know, new breakthroughs, incredible new breakthroughs, create new problems. And you have to see this dialectic of progress and pathology very accurately if you're going to be able to accurately understand the evolutionary process. So, you know, these are just some of the things that you really need to add to the picture of evolution to begin to appreciate, have a richer view of human consciousness and culture. But a lot of people are doing this, and I wanted to highlight those theorists and theories that are doing it and really make a strong argument for it. But, you know, this isn't just, you know, for the last couple hundred years, for most of the last couple hundred years, it was just great individuals that had this kind of point of view, that were kind of carrying the torch of this evolutionary perspective. But now we've gone beyond the great individuals. We're actually starting to have there's a movement forming. There's kind of a groundswell and a tremendous interest in these ideas by a larger movement of individuals. But we're still, you know, this is still on the relative fringe of the mainstream culture, and the mainstream culture doesn't really countenance these kinds of ideas. So we need people to get out and engage in the debates and discussions that are happening in mainstream culture. And I hope the book is able to be one more thing that can begin to influence some minds and get the conversation going.
Great. Well, I think so. And one of the things that I like about it is that it links, in a very grounded and intellectually rigorous way, discussions of philosophy and science and other evidence-based considerations with what ultimately becomes much more philosophical, existential, and even spiritual. And in fact, that's part of your title. And you do end up with a couple of chapters specifically on evolutionary spirituality. So why don't you kind of make those connections for everyone listening? How is what are the spiritual implications of this evolutionary worldview?
Well, just to preface that, I really do think that one of the characteristics of evolution is that it connects disparate fields of endeavor. You know, Teilhard de Chardin, the great Jesuit priest and paleontologist, has this great quote where he said, "Evolution is a light that illumines all facts, a curve that all lines must follow." And it's a beautiful quote, and it kind of captures the way in which, you know, evolution is one of those, it's not only a powerful idea, it's a powerful meta idea, in the sense that it kind of contextualizes so many different fields of endeavor. And we need ideas like that right now in our culture. You know, one of the issues with our culture is we've become so specialized and so powerfully specialized that, you know, we lack the people who are able to kind of grasp knowledge as a whole, grasp human culture as a whole. We lack the perspective sometimes of a generalist, of an integralist. You know, that's the word, obviously, we use around this. But we need that perspective. We need people who can kind of grasp things as a whole. And evolution is one of those areas that, because it includes, and I hope people get a sense as they read the book, evolution, it does. It applies to, you know, science, and applies to technology, and applies to human culture, and applies to even to spirituality, you know, which is an area where we haven't really, you know, it hasn't commonly been thought of to apply so directly. So I think that's one of the most important ideas about evolution. It does link all these things. So evolutionary spirituality is to me, of course, it's very close to my heart, and I think it's one of the most important aspects of what where evolution is pointing to us. And just to say, you know, very simply, I think that, you know, several people, including Teilhard de Chardin, and including the great Indian sage Sri Aurobindo, were very seminal in bringing the idea of evolution. They were writing maybe 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years after Darwin, and they would help kind of bring the idea of development and bring the idea of evolution at a cultural and kind of even cosmic level and give it this kind of, you know, bring it into this spiritual and religious dimension. And basically, they both strongly disagreed and pushed away from the idea that's been so prevalent in so many religious traditions over the last couple thousand years, that the deeper dimensions of the religious revelation and of mysticism somehow take us away from the world. They push us away from the world toward a more transcendent state of being, that's where the action is, that's where we should be focused, that's where our attention and our consciousness really need to rest. That's the goal, ultimately. That this world is sort of, you know, it's seen in different ways and different traditions, but it really shouldn't be the final focus of our attentions and affections, in some sense. And they really pushed against that idea. They really said, wait a minute. You know, in an evolutionary context, actually, while we may experience and have very deep states of transcendence and mystical insights, while we may, you know, awaken to very deep perceptions of the nature of the mystical nature of reality, ultimately those should lead us to a deeper form of engagement in this world, a deeper form of contribution to this world, a deeper form and a more liberated way of actually contributing to the development of consciousness and culture in this world. And that's why Teilhard, in one of his original, you know, books, the dedication in one of his most important works is, it says, for those who love this world. And he was pushing off against the opposite view. And of course, this is what's so important to my own spiritual sensibility. As you said in your intro, my own spiritual teacher and mentor has been Andrew Cohen, who's really taken up this tradition, and his own teaching of evolutionary enlightenment has been critical in continuing to develop this evolutionary tradition, evolutionary lineage of spiritual thinking and spiritual thought and spiritual realization. But that's the, you know, there's a many different elements to it, but that's the essential message. You know, transcendence is in the service of evolution, in the service of the greater development of consciousness and culture, not the other way around. So,
well, this is a very nuanced and, in some quarters, pretty controversial area of investigation. I know that I have talked with a number of beautiful awakened teachers in this series whose work focuses on awakening itself, you know, awakening from identification with the body-mind, awakening from your story and your stories about the world and life and others, awakening from your interpretations of experience and the motives that arise on that basis to the limpid clarity of just this, of this moment, of it, the infinite mystery of being. And on a number of occasions when I or others have presented an integral or evolutionary perspective, I've heard a challenge coming from longtime practitioners who often don't resonate with that, and sometimes they're very cool people who are very gentle and compassionate, but they basically are saying or implying something along the lines of, you know, all that evolutionary stuff sounds persuasive, but I hope you're not getting so caught up in believing your mind that you're losing your ability to really stand in a free, awakened relationship to your moment-to-moment experience. You know, essentially they're suggesting that our integral evolutionary philosophy is going to tend to function like a Trojan horse to just get us back into the wheel of identification, differentiation, desire, aversion, and unaligned bondage. And, you know, that if we're not free, whatever we're into, even if it sounds really evolved, is just another mind hallucination, another dream you need to wake up from. So, you know, what do you say to that?
Well, this is a great and the great question, and this is such an important issue, and it's an issue I feel strongly about, partially because I care about mysticism. I care about those deeper dimensions of spiritual life, those deeper liberated dimensions. As you know, I'm a serious spiritual practitioner. I've been doing and pursuing the nature of enlightenment, the nature of deeper forms of spiritual practice for 20 years. This is not something. This is not a casual interest of mine. This is not those levels. I understand those concerns, and not just intellectually, but spiritually, but experientially. I understand those dimensions, and I understand the importance that people feel about, hey, you know, I'm just experiencing a certain type of truth and meaning in moving away from the kind of the rat race of the mind and of this world and of everything that's going on. I'm finally experiencing some liberation from that. I'm finally discovering myself to be free fundamentally of all of that. And here you're telling me I have to re-engage in it? What is it? You know, you want me to just get lost in it again? Is that, you know, how can that be an expression of liberation? How can that be, you know, a deeper dimension of the spiritual life? How can that be true? And so I think we have to be nuanced, and we have to recognize there's a couple of very important distinctions to that really do make this evolutionary spirituality an authentic form of liberation, not just another way of like, well, I'm going to experiencing some deeper sense of liberation, and then I'm going to help, you know, do my social activism. You know, that's good, that's fine. But this is something a little bit different, and I think it does point to the way in which spirituality itself is evolving, and that is that there are forms of awakening itself, and there are forms of touching upon that which is transcendent that don't just point us beyond this world, that don't just point us away and behind and below all the forms and features of this world, but this is what, you know, my own mentor Andrew calls the evolutionary impulse. But there is this creative dimension to awakening, this creative dimension to non-duality, this creative evolutionary dimension to enlightenment, so to speak.
You know, go ahead.
When we connect with that, when we recognize that, that dimension as well, it touches upon the infinite. There is a liberation in that, but it's a liberation not from something, but you feel liberated to participate, to contribute, not just forced or called. There's an actual experience of liberation, beyond the mind, beyond all of those aspects that the mystic wants to free himself from. That is also part of the experience of this kind of creative impulse, this creative liberation, this evolutionary liberation. So
are you suggesting then that we're talking about two different awakenings, that there's an awakening from the world, but there's a different awakening back into the world? And is this a higher awakening or a different awakening, or are these different expressions of the same fundamental mystical process?
Well, I think I probably would go with the latter in the end. It's a different expressions of the same fundamental mystical process. But I also think that mysticism is itself not static. That while there are certain types of deeper awakenings that probably don't vary that far from the kinds of mystical awakenings we've been having for the last 2,000 years, or the last 3,000 years, you know, I think that we are also, there are new forms of the way in which, you know, as Ken Wilber's been very adept at saying, you know, the way in which we experience this world of form, it affects those deeper dimensions of our own mystical experience. And so I think mysticism itself is also evolving. So there are new types of experiences that are emerging in their own time. And one of those is this recognition of this deeper, liberated, creative impulse. Now, if you read Aurobindo, he's beautiful, because this was someone who was very deeply grounded in the Eastern Enlightenment, and his own experience was so rich of that. And he talks about the danger and the temptation when you are very deeply grounded in a mystical, liberated, almost traditional perspective of enlightenment. There can be a way in which you start to relate to the world as just, you know, this play of shadows, this play of this kind of unreal world. And we have to recognize there's a deep authenticity to that. That's an authentic expression of a very powerful form of enlightenment. But what I'm pointing to is something different than that. That there's also a way to begin to re-engage with the world, re-engage with consciousness and culture and human life from this perspective, without just getting lost back in the samsaric world, by you know, recognizing.
In order to really make this as fruitful a dialogue as possible, Carter, I think my job might be to here show up a little bit more as the devil's advocate, because I certainly see people who have really cleaved to the more traditional point and just focused on awakening really being a more reliable window beyond immersion in the mind's kind of constant chatter than some of those who are participants in integral evolutionary culture. And there is sometimes, it seems to me even, a need to course correct back toward transcendence of the mind and immersion in the mind, waking back up to this and to the incredible, limpid freedom from mind forms and all the rest. And that even that even when we try to penetrate the dream through a more awakened synthesis and come alive in a higher inspiration, it is easy to get caught up in the content of experience in a way that is more like bondage. I don't think we can posit everything in integral evolutionary culture as all being beyond the conventional awakening. And so don't these two principles need to remain in a kind of creative and dynamic tension? And doesn't the evolutionary perspective can't it be subverted into functioning like a Trojan horse at times? And doesn't it need to rise up to its highest expressions in order to really answer this challenge?
Well, the simple answer to that, the simple answer is yes. There's no doubt, and I agree, that these two dimensions, let's say, these two dimensions of mysticism, let's say traditional mysticism and evolutionary mysticism, both of which are liberating, both of which are powerful forms of freedom, they need to remain in a creative tension, as you beautifully put it. And this is not either or, in the sense that I would be advocating that someone sort of abandoned any impulse toward this traditional mysticism. I have an impulse toward that. It's very important that we all experience ourselves beyond the, you know, the machinations of time and form and the mind, that we all have that experience, and that we all, you know, recognize our identity as being beyond that in some primal and fundamental way. That is part of That's why I, you know, meditate every day. That's why I do retreats every year. That's why I, you know, to take the time to make sure that one is grounded in that kind of perspective and that kind of deeper reality. So I agree that that's critical, and that this is not a one or the other thing, you know. But the only thing I would say is that fundamentally, where is our loyalty, let's say? Where is our affection? And I think for those who are evolutionaries at heart, and those who, there's the opportunity to care, to care very deeply about this world and the future of this world in a way that is in no way in opposition to one's spiritual impulse. And that's what evolutionary spirituality frees us to be. In the traditional religious context, or even a traditional mystical context, there is this kind of tension. There's this kind of like, yeah, you can care for the suffering and you can care, but you know, the real thing is not really there. The real thing is back here. And what evolutionary spirituality, it liberates you from the sense that this isn't where it's at. That the real thing is somewhere else, you know. I believe, and I feel strongly that the real thing is here. It's right here. It doesn't mean that we don't need to rest very deeply in the mystical, unmanifest dimension of life, and to do it regularly, to do it as so that we are very deeply grounded there. That's critical. That's important. But, you know, but when it comes to it, I'm not sure, you know, there's going to be a place where our deep attention, affection, and loyalty lies. And I think that's what I'm pointing to in terms of evolutionary spirituality, that one doesn't need to be divided in some deep way, that one can care about all of this with one's attention not being, well, it's still really about this. You know, because look, even in the Bodhisattva vow, right, beautiful expression of compassion, even in the Bodhisattva vow of Tibetan Buddhism, you know, the real thing in the end is to free everyone to get out of here. And I just, in the end, that's not the predilection of evolutionary spirituality. It doesn't mean that there's not power into that form of mysticism and critical importance to it. But in the end, this is real. And
I so resonate with this. And it seems to me that there's an important distinction between the kind of urgency that people feel from a place of egoic identification and
exactly
threat and anxiety, and the kind of urgency that arises on the basis of this kind of awakening, which is very positive, optimistic, and fundamentally free rather than fundamentally bound.
Just to pull on that, that's a beautiful thing. The kind of urgency that arises from the evolutionary dimension, evolutionary impulse, is fundamentally free. It's urgent, but it's fundamentally free. And I think that kind of, you know, and it's a different kind of care, too. There's a kind of care for this world. You see, if our attention is fundamentally kind of, you know, I think in a more traditional religious or even mystical approach, there's a form of compassion that's beautiful and powerful and certainly plays its role in the spiritual life, but it's sort of a compassion for it's a compassion for suffering. And to kind of make everything better until we're all kind of liberated. It's not quite that, but it's a form of compassion.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
It's fundamentally life negative and world negative rather than
fully given
hope.
Really, if you track it down, it's fundamentally life negative. And this kind of care, the care for the future, the care for evolution, it's fundamentally life positive. You really break it down. And again, it's not to say that one's bad or one's good, but if you break it down, they're different. They come from different expressions.
And in a way, it can arise from a radically liberated perspective. You're liberated not just from the identification with ego and life and the embeddedness in the wheel of birth and death, but you're liberated from the need to escape it, and you're liberated from all points of view into simple, ecstatic incarnation.
Yes, beautifully put. Beautifully put. Beautifully put.
Well, great. Go ahead.
Well, and in some ways, I think that while, you know, it's interesting to see, I think, you know, in our own time, I think the Buddhist tradition has been so powerful and so beautiful at expressing for a contemporary mind some of the deeper aspects of the contemplative and mystical tradition. And it really has done that so well, and it served a great purpose in doing that. But it's been difficult, I think, for some of the Buddhist culture to embrace an evolutionary perspective for exactly this reason that we're speaking about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to move on to one other important point before we take our break and move on to questions, Carter. And that is the fundamental question that animates this series. How can higher consciousness help us rise to meet the challenges of our world? And there's a bit of a debate among some evolutionaries in which, you know, I've, for instance, I've heard our dear friend Steve McIntosh was going to be a guest here in just a couple of months, I think, or less, on this series, say that the most important thing we can do is to build this new worldview, and that therefore philosophical and spiritual, you know, the kind of thing that this series is devoted to, the kind of thing your book represents, which are essentially building new understandings and helping those be more robust and clear and getting more people involved in that conversation and understanding how to live it, that that's the important thing to do. Whereas other people are saying, and I've been one of those who's been out there saying it, actually, in this recent blog post that many of our listeners have probably read, Occupy Integral, that we actually need to be engaged in this world right now as participants, that to stand back and go meta and look at the big picture and see the patterns is just not enough. We're citizens of a world in process, and there are lots of pretty negative and relatively positive dynamics. And if we're not participants in the fray in a real way right now, bringing our higher consciousness to bear, we're kind of copping out. How do you see that tension between theory and action?
Great question. And there's a lot to speak about in this. And I just think it's a great tension point right now. A lot of people are talking about this. And I mean, I do think that often the importance of theory in terms of building the structures of this worldview and the structures of this new perspective are underestimated, and that people are kind of so anxious to have an impact, you know, and for good reason. I understand why people care. You know, people care and they're concerned and they want to have a big impact and they want things to change, and so they're so anxious for that. They hear a new idea and they want to apply it, you know, like the next moment. You know, it's like, and that's cool. That I kind of respect that impulse, and yet it can be misguided in the sense that this is not just another new idea we can apply. I believe that this is a more fundamental idea. This is a big new idea that's actually so big, it's going to take some time to build out the framework of it. It's like if you're building a skyscraper. I'm in New York right now. I'm looking at all these skyscrapers. You know, if you're building a skyscraper, you kind of have to build. You have to get the foundations right. You have to get the first kind of few stories right, and you have to get the designs right, and then you can build the whole thing. But if you kind of want to build that 14th floor too quickly before everything is kind of set, you know, you'll end up having to go to you'll end up having to go to another skyscraper that's already built in order to do that. And so we want to make sure we build this in the right way. We want to make sure we don't rush off to do things that are just premature. You know, it was premature, you know, to have a very powerful new democratic governance in the 15th century or 16th century. But, you know, by the time the 18th century came around, the philosophy of modernity and the philosophy of the Western Enlightenment had enough legs to it to begin to actually, wow, create this new way of doing governance. You know, it had enough power to it, had enough legs to it, and the opportunity came along. So we don't want to rush out and do things too quick. So that is critical. You know, there's this beautiful line, Thomas D. Zingatita, who wrote this book called Mediated, one of my personal favorite theorists, and he wrote a beautiful article a number of years ago for Harper, where at the end of the article he said, you know, go and throw a brick through a Starbucks window if you want, but don't think that makes you a radical. The real radicals are in the library, and they're trying to understand the direction of history, and they're trying to understand the nature of this moment and how to respond to it. And, you know, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but I do think there's something to that. You know, there's a radical form of activism in building the structures of a new worldview. So we don't want to underestimate the critical power of that. These are not just intellectual ideas. These are building, ratcheting actual structures, non-physical structures, but structures in consciousness and culture. That's what we're building here. It's not just ideas. These are more than ideas. Okay, so that being said, I've always been passionate about politics. I've always cared about the nature of the world we're living in. I don't believe we can live in ivory towers. I don't believe we can avoid the world as it exists. I care that the Supreme Court upheld Obamacare. I care about, you know, I care about those things, and I'm engaged in those things every day. And I don't think you can be an informed citizen, and you know, people should be voting. They should be engaged. They should be doing all kinds of things. So I don't think those two are contradictory, even though I know they can. There's a tension there. I think there's a synthetic position. So, and I think it's critical. And look, I'm involved in a new think tank to bring some of these ideas to help deal with some of the problems like climate change, like, you know, just like a lot of the political gridlock that is happening in our culture right now. I want to see how these ideas can be brought to bear on those issues. You know, I feel passionate about those. I feel passionate about that. But, you know, we need to be careful that we don't outrun ourselves. And otherwise, our worldview won't be strong. It won't be.
Yeah,
it won't,
yeah.
And it won't have the lasting power it should.
That's beautiful. I love the way you advocated for the importance of advancing the worldview and building a culture. But there still is a controversy, even among people who are participating in that process of culture building, in which some of them are essentially saying to others, "Hey, you know, it's not cool for you to be completely passive, not make any donations, not do any political activism, maybe at most just go and vote, maybe sign a couple of online petitions, but be relatively passive while we watch this kind of retrogressive." You know, a lot of people feel that the current direction of some aspects of conservative politics is pretty negative and is going to create problems. I mean, would you urge people to get involved and try to make sure that Obama is reelected, for example, right now? Most evolutionaries seem, you know, to line up there. Would you challenge that point of view? Would you say, no, evolutionaries might want to vote for Romney? Would you, you know, where does your advocacy end up at the end of the day?
Well, you're asking me now my political preferences. That's good. I didn't expect that. That's not my usual. I don't usually get asked that in interviews. It's good. No, I'm a Obama supporter. I don't agree with everything he's doing, but I feel strongly that he should. I feel strongly that he should be elected. I will spend a lot of, you know, time and energy hoping that he gets elected next year. And so there's, you know, I think to some extent, I think some of this also comes down to one's own predilections. You know, some people are just more activist-oriented by nature. They're going to be more deeply involved in the dynamics of the political process. That's just more their predilection, and that's more their talent, and that's more their energy and ambition, you know. And so I think that's there's nothing wrong with that. That's great. But I know, like, you could see what happened with Obama, right? Because so many people had such – they invested certain types of hopes in his – presidency, and I think a lot of people feel that somehow he let them down, and I think that was, again, I think it was a kind of a mistake of the moment. You know, he don't get me wrong, I think he's been a good president and a much better president than so many other people would have been, but still, you know, he's operating in a certain type of structure and a certain type of society and a certain type of way of doing things, and he's doing. And he has a certain kind of limited power in that. And I think people who, you know, maybe invested that, you know, too much was going to change just because we got him elected. The structures of culture and the nature of evolution is more complex than that. It's more delicate than that. And if we want, what I want, you know, what I really care deeply about is that we put into place the kinds of new structures and powerful new features of culture that are so persuasive and so important and so real and represent such a move, evolutionary move forward, that they inform our politics in 50 years, that in 50 or in 40, 50, 60, 70 years, that they have a huge impact in 40, 50, 60, 70 years, 100 years. Even if they don't, even if we can't see, it doesn't mean we shouldn't work for it today, but even if we can't see that kind of impact in 30 or 40 years, even if we can't see tremendous impact, I want to see, you know, a huge impact down the line, and I want to put the foundations in place for that. But I think people should get involved. I mean, by all means, you know. But don't get involved in a way that causes you to lose sight of how evolution works, actually works. You know, evolution, it does take time. It works in particular ways. The world isn't all going to wake up in 2012 and just because we, you know, a bunch of people want us to. We aren't just going to all reach a new level of consciousness just like that. That's not the way things work, you know. Sometimes people have all kinds of unrealistic ambitions about and unrealistic idealism about the way consciousness and culture work, and unrealistic idealism is usually related to cynicism. That's the swing, you know. You're unrealistically idealistic, and then you go back, and then you're cynical. And the beautiful thing about a deeper understanding of the evolution of consciousness and culture, it allows you to be very optimistic, but very realistic as well. And that's to me the sweet spot. And so we should see our contributions, whether we're really involved or not so much involved, you know. But we see our contributions in that sweet spot.
That's beautiful. I really love it. This is going to be a rich context for this next dialogue I'm going to be having with Jim Turner. So I really appreciate that, Carter. Well, you know, I want to go into all these things more deeply, and I'm sure many of the folks listening to us want to also. So let's take our break for some announcements, and then I will invite questions. So if any of you have questions, please go ahead and raise your hand by pressing *2 if you've called in on the phone, or you can type in questions if you're listening via computer into the instant teleseminar window. Now, first, I want to make sure you know how to find out more about Carter and his book and his work. The book title is Evolutionaries, Unlocking the Spiritual and Cultural Potential of Science's Greatest Idea. And it's really a terrific read. I highly recommend that everybody get a copy and read it. And you can get that pretty much at any bookstore. It's published by HarperCollins, so it's widely available online and really, you know, at any neighborhood bookstore or chain. Additionally, you can find out more about Carter and his work schedule by visiting his website, carterphipps.com, carterphipps.com, and you can be sure to sign up for his email list while you're there. And then additionally, you can go to enlightennext.org to see his blog and the work he does with his colleagues there, who the other students of Andrew Cohen, who are also furthering an evolutionary view. Is there anything else you want to draw to people's attention, Carter?
I think you covered it, Terry. That's great. And I hope people have a chance to read the book and it really unpacks so many of the things we've talked about today. But they were great questions. I really appreciate going into some of these points and really.
Yeah.
You know,
we'll be going on and taking questions here in a moment. I want to make you be aware also of a couple of my own offerings. Next month in August, from the 13th to the 19th, I'll be appearing at Next Step Integral's Integral Community Seminar in Loveland, Colorado. And in just a few days, you'll notice a new website that will go up announcing Birthing a New We, a one-year awakening intensive with Thomas Hubel and myself. And for one pivotal year, beginning this September, we're going to practice together with a group of passionate evolutionary practitioners to co-create a new spiritual consciousness and culture. Thomas and I are looking for individuals who are willing to make a profound shift in their lives while contributing to a collective awakening, both in our small group, and ultimately in our global humanity. So you'll be able to find out more about both of these events, and you can sign up for my newsletter as well by visiting terrypatten.com, TerryPatten.com, and clicking the links associated with both these things. Also, please stay on the line to the end of the call, and I'll tell you a little more about what's coming up with our upcoming guests in 2 weeks on July 15th. I'll be talking with Jim Turner about the innate natural intelligence of the body politic. We'll kind of continue this political side of the conversation there. We also have interviews coming out soon with Cynthia Bergeau, Steve McIntosh, Shyam Doge, Daniel Pinchbeck, and I have even more to tell you about at the end of the call. Okay, let's see. We have, let's take a live question right off the bat. I think this is Eric Troth calling. Hi, Eric.
Yes, hi. Thank you. Yeah, I'm so appreciating the depth of the exchange that the two of you have been having. And Carter, just to really honor the depth of your caring, born of all the years of practice that you've done, that really shows through. And I appreciate the passion behind your words that really speaks to me and enlivens me. And I think, where I want to go with this, I had some ideas of a question, and it keeps on evolving as I'm listening to the interview and unfolding. But you've emphasized how evolution implicates the individual, and that it's not just an intellectual idea, that we have that part, but there's also a response that's more visceral. And so what I'm wanting to hear you flesh out is, how do we work with that in our own spiritual practice, that there can be these different impulses that we experience, that there's that tendency to, I think, sometimes move off into a type of transcendent spirituality that can be a dodge, that's an avoidance. And there's times that we can also lean more towards that engagement activist orientation that can leave the more transcendent dimension behind. And what I hear the two of you fleshing out is how it's the both and. There's almost a paradox of holding two things, you know, at the same time that seem very different. And so as we work with those natural tendencies in ourselves, how do we really, you know, how do we sit with that when, you know, when we're on the cushion, when we're, you know, noticing our mind? How do we notice that, you know, in our interactions? What would be your practice tips to really embody more fully what you've been talking about?
Well, thanks, Eric. That's a great question, and I mean, there's a few different ways to answer that, but I just as a way to contextualize it, I think there. You know, you see this issue a lot. You know, people who care deeply as activists, but they get kind of lost in that, you know, the frustrations of trying to change a very intransigent world, and they kind of get burned out in that effort. And then they kind of revert back to maybe more trying to change themselves or trying to work on themselves or reach a deeper level of kind of peace and liberation and transcendence, but there's a sort of a sense of being kind of disconnected in that. And of course, at its worst, it can become kind of solipsistic and narcissistic, and then we kind of disconnect ourselves from the world. And to me, evolutionary spirituality, well, you know, it recognizes the critical function of both of those positions, but to me kind of avoids and transcends the pathologies of each in some sense. You know, so it recognizes the power of mysticism and of self-inquiry and of changing oneself and of the need to become a very deep interior reflection of the kind of change we're seeking in the world and in society. It recognizes the need for that without becoming so focused on that dimension or on this, you know, deeper internal dimension of self, because it connects that change. It connects interior change to cultural change. And that's why recognizing the evolution of culture and the relationship between the culture and consciousness is so critical. Because we start to connect our own change to these dimensions. dimensions of cultural change. We start to see those as being kind of two parts of one large system. And then we start to, you know, we won't see ourselves in such an isolated context anymore. We won't see our own development in such a isolated context. And likewise, we start to recognize, well, it's not just changing the helping people and changing the institutions out there. We actually also need to work at a deeper layer to build these new structures of consciousness. That's all like a deeper layer of cultural change. And when we begin to acknowledge that deeper layer of cultural change is important, that it has reality, and that it's connected to, you know, understanding these kind of deeper evolutionary dimensions, then we don't see our own spiritual lives and our own spiritual development and the depth of our own spiritual engagement as so separate, as such a separate activity. It's not, you know, it's not just its own thing. It's inherently and intrinsically connected to that kind of social activism. So you start to see the relationship between all these things. Instead of being these kind of isolated pockets of activity, you start to see the integral nature of the relationship between all these things. And that's to me is one of the most powerful gifts of an evolutionary world.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah, appreciating that there's, you know, there's what we experience in our practice as we notice these structures in our mind, but it's the theory too that helps us to recognize those structures. Otherwise, you know, we don't have a framework. I can notice the impulses arising one way or another, but, you know, how do I make sense of that? And that's why I really appreciate your, you know, contextualizing that too with a, you know, theoretical dimension so that we understand, and then that framework helps us to move forward.
And the other thing, Eric, I would say is that, you know, the nature of this kind of work and the nature of this kind of engagement and the nature of this kind of practice, even very deep, at deep spiritual levels, it's not something you can't, it's hard to do alone. You know, the very nature of it has to do with engagement, you know. Even, you know, and look at my own path, even a lot of what I, obviously there's a place, I'm not speaking against, there's a place for solitary spiritual practice and a critical place for it. But even at the level of spiritual practice, engaging with other people and all of these issues is critical. And I think, you know, for evolutionaries, even more so. It's always been that way probably to some degree, but for evolutionaries even more so. You need that, you know, especially with where we are in culture with this whole perspective, you just need that kind of engagement. You need it spiritually, you need it socially, you need it at many levels. I think that's critical.
Mm. Yeah. Thank
so
you.
So
yeah, thank you very
my
much.
My number one tip, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. The engagement. And if I may, just to mention, because I do a lot of practice groups around this, and sometimes with people who are Beyond Awakening series fans, and just if anybody wants to join that practice group exploring your call, you know, right after this, like 5 minutes after we finish here, just go to a bit.ly address, bit.ly/BA after chat, and just a small informal group, and we'll continue this discussion that you're having with Terry after you finish. So,
oh, that's
yeah,
cool, Eric. Why don't you repeat the URL?
Yeah, it's just your http://, your standard start, bit.ly/BA after chat.
Okay,
and
cool. Thanks, thanks
to a
so
page
much.
Where
Eric.
They can, yeah, enjoy with that.
Thanks,
thank
Eric.
You. Yeah, thank you for allowing me to
All right,
plug
great.
That. Appreciate your.
Okay, taking now some of the many questions that people have typed in, and this is so rich. They're really intelligent questions that are coming in here from all kinds of different directions, Carter. So maybe I can invite you to offer relatively brief answers to a series
okay.
of good questions.
I'll work on that.
Well, here's a quick one, I think. Liz White from Clearwater, Minnesota asks, in the context of this discussion, is the term development synonymous with evolution?
Yeah, I think sometimes I get tired of using the word evolution so much. I like to mix it up with development. So yes, relatively it is. I think yes, more or less it is. I think for the purposes of there are probably some distinctions we can make, but more or less I think I just get tired of using the word evolution quite a bit.
Yeah, okay, makes sense. John in the UK asks a couple of questions. The first one I think would be great for you to have a chance to comment on at least briefly. What's the difference between process philosophy and evolution?
Well, I think process philosophy was a very, you know, for those who don't know, process philosophy was a philosophy developed initially by Alfred North Whitehead, who is really one of the first great, you know, one of the original great evolutionaries of the 20th century. And so he was a pioneer in this way of thinking, and process philosophy was a critical kind of, you know, early foundational seminal element of evolutionary philosophy. So I mean, I think process philosophy has a whole set of principles, you know, some of which, you know, times have moved on and, you know, 100 years have passed. It wouldn't be that, you know, we may have moved on past some of them, but I think process philosophy is one of those philosophies that's been a critical foundational piece of an evolutionary worldview. So.
Okay, great. And here's a question on a different topic, but I do want to offer you a chance to take a quick pass at it. David doesn't give us his location, but he asks, is the age of the guru over? What will be the role of individual charismatic teachers in this new time of collective evolution?
Well, David, I'm probably the wrong person to ask about that, given that I have a guru and a spiritual teacher and mentor who's been incredibly, you know, transformative in my own life and has had a huge impact on my own spiritual development. So you have to decide whether I'm objective or not, but I have a bias on this one and a strong feeling about it. So, you know, I understand that is not the role, you know, that's not the path for everyone, and not everyone is going to choose to engage with a spiritual teacher in that way. But if one is so inclined, it can be a very powerful, transformative path, and of course it has to be the right person, the right time, for the right context, but it certainly can be powerful. Boy, it's almost a whole nother question. I'm a little hesitant to kind of get into a whole discussion about the role of the teacher and the guru in spiritual in the future, and I'm not even, you know, most of it would probably be speculative, but look, I mean, we have to realize that hierarchies of all kinds are important for our development. You know, we need to learn from people who know more than us in all kinds of areas, in all kinds of ways. And we need to mentor people who know less than us in all kinds of areas, in all kinds of ways. That's part of life, and we need to recognize that. And, of course, we need to recognize it with all the nuance and appreciation for the dangers of hierarchy, and the dangers of arrogance, and the dangers of superiority, and the dangers of those power relationships. But we still need to do it, and we still need to engage in those kinds of activities. So hierarchy is going to continue to be important in some form or other for a long time to go. As long as evolution is happening, hierarchy is going to be important. So yeah, I think I'll probably leave that question at that. But
that's great. Thank you. Well, I want to take another live question. You know, Carter, there are so many rich questions that people have typed in. Really, I think it will enrich this dialogue. Would it be possible for you to stick on the line maybe a little beyond our original end time? That would be great.
Sure.
There's a couple more hands up here that I want to try to take. John Beck or someone at a phone listed to him in Sanford, North Carolina. You're on the air. Please introduce yourself.
Yeah, hi. I really appreciate
What's your name?
My name's Pamela.
Oh, hi, Pam.
Hi, Terry. I really appreciated your discussion about mysticism, and I agree that that contemporary mysticism would perhaps have a different quality. There's a different cultural influence to it. I myself found a tremendous, I felt like I didn't understand my own mystical doubt until I had read the medieval mystics, which I know coming from an integral perspective, you know, that you'd be aligned with that. But I get the point about the moving away from the world, sort of the via negativa versus sort of going towards activism and altering and contributing. But I guess I'm just still a little wanting a little more clarity around the distinction you see between the two. Does that make sense?
Could you say more what you mean by specific where you're looking for clarity?
Yeah, because I see, for example, you know, there were certain mystics in the medieval era that did get involved in the world as a part of their mysticism, and others that withdrew and led contemplative, isolated existences, and also just because there seems to be such profound resonances about sort of the experience of the stages that are gone through, that I guess I just wanted a little more.
Yes, I mean, I'm not sure. I'm another question, but I mean, those are very beautiful and powerful forms of mysticism. I mean, there are. I mean, look, the spiritual life is rich and ecstatic in all kinds of ways, and the expressions of it are many. You know, and the expressions of mysticism itself are many and varied and powerful, and there's certainly different forms, and people have mapped those forms, and I was very drawn as a young man to that path, and still am. There's a beauty and power to mysticism and to those kinds of, I think, the kinds of mystics you're talking about. I presume I know who you're talking about. I've read a lot of those as well, and there's nothing like the literature on mysticism. It's just gore. It's compelling and powerful. And for anyone who's a spiritual soul, you know, and a spiritually inclined soul, it's very rich. But so that's great. And I don't think there's anything much to say about that except that. But you know, I think there's a new form of mysticism emerging in our time that doesn't discount earlier or other forms. But it is a legitimate and powerful and very relevant form for our contemporary time. And some people, and it's not just, you know, stapling together mysticism and activism. You know, that's what some traditions do, to kind of just try to put those together. But it's an organic form of evolutionary mysticism that, and part of the actual liberation is recognizing the desire to evolve oneself and one's culture at the level of consciousness, and culture, and it's a new form of evolutionary mysticism, and it's I think it will develop in its own way over time. It doesn't mean that those other forms and other very rich forms of religious and spiritual expression are going to go the way of the, you know, they're going to be lost or go away. I'm sure they'll continue with us, but spirit is evolving, and at the edge of evolution, I think new forms are being created, and they're very powerful, and they're very relevant, and they're very relevant to our own time and culture.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pam. Thank you, Carter.
Does that help, Pam? Does that help? I don't know if I...
Absolutely, 100%.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Okay, I want to go on to some of the remarkable questions we have. Here's one from a very sophisticated thinker, Nilesh Marik, I think maybe I pronounced his name, from Kolkata, India. Just as the cop-out argument applies to the being-becoming dialectic, traditional versus evolutionary enlightenment, doesn't the same dynamic apply to the becoming-doing dialectic? Doesn't that necessitate a new structure of collective engagement whereby every evolutionary plays the right role in the right layer of consciousness and culture, systems and processes, and hands-on day-to-day problem-solving in intimate coordination with each other? Our world hasn't been able to produce this new structure of collective engagement. Isn't that probably a lower right artifact waiting to be birthed?
I'm not sure I understood all that.
I think he's kind of saying that if we're to be activists, doesn't that activism need to have lower right structures, like if just individuals trying to be activists is probably not it, that this evolutionary worldview needs to give birth to responsible lower right structures that we don't really see yet. And isn't that an urgent emergent that needs to come into being?
Yes, no doubt, no doubt. And we could have long discussions about which quadrant, you know, leads evolution, or which should, or which is going to at this point in history, you know, from an integral theory perspective. You know, we could have, but certainly eventually there's going to have to be robust lower right structures, institutions of culture and politics and economics and social institutions that themselves will exert. You know, that's when you begin to have robust forms of those, that's when you know the worldview is starting to take hold, you know, and starting to really and create its own tension. You know, democracy creates its own evolutionary tension around the world in terms of, you know, in terms of moving culture forward. But you can't create those until you can create them. You know, you can't actually, and I don't mean that just, you know, I'm not trying to be trite. That you can't actually create those robust institutional structures until the perspective and the people are actually in place enough and have evolved enough and is rich enough and is, you know, is full enough and developed enough to do it. I think we're getting there, but these are still new ideas. These are
So maybe the new think tank is one such institutional structure, or even all of us gathering here on this call it's a lower right structure. It's not a hugely powerful cultural institution yet, nor is the think tank, but perhaps these are the seeds out of which such things might evolve and emerge.
Yeah, and I look forward to seeing, as people start to develop these ideas, you know, what you're going to start to see over time, people are going to start to take these kind of more seminal versions of this worldview and evolutionary and integral ideas, and then they're going to turn them into very powerful expression, institutional expressions. And you're going to see that over time, and that's going to be beautiful to watch. But we're still at the early days of that, and often now, or up to the last years, when you've generally seen that, they would usually be very rooted in earlier worldviews and earlier expressions, and they weren't kind of in structures that you could really say are fully integral, fully evolutionary, that really are full expressions of these theories of new ideas. But I'm sure over time we are going to see some that are, and we're already starting to see that. And I think the more that happens, it's just that's what's so exciting about this kind of emergence. You suddenly see, wow, it's this proliferation of new forms. Just like in evolution, right? You see, it's like a proliferation of new forms. You know, when you see when you see a new species, you see in the fossil record, you see this proliferation of new forms, and then evolution sort of winnows out the forms and feature and that are functional, that are most functional, and then that's where evolution goes. It takes those most functional forms, and you're going to see the same thing as this.
Right, right, great. Thank you, Carter. You know, I want to get a few more of these great questions in, and perhaps one more live question if we have time for it. Ernest Zito in Oakland asks a great, very direct question. He says, concretely, in terms of the next two decades, what issues do you think should be central in culture? If there were an evolutionary's political party, what would be its platform? Otherwise, there's nothing in your theory that says humanity can't just thin itself out significantly, learn its painful lesson, and from the remnants that survive, a new humanity can rise from the ashes. But that's a pretty painful way to evolve.
That's a part of the question.
That's a side comment. But I think the concrete platform and what should be central are the core of the question.
Well, just to say, it's like for us to experience, yes, we could go through a disaster and we could just kind of slide down the evolutionary chain temporarily before we kind of rebuild. But that's a painful, and maybe that, you know, that can be a means to deeper evolution, you know, over time. But boy, that's a painful and difficult way to do it. And there's no guarantee you get back up anytime soon from that kind of disaster. So, you know, I wouldn't wish that on us. And, you know, and obviously, we're working to avoid that kind of thing. So the question was, what would be the political platform of the next two decades? And
And what should be at the center of culture and consideration? What should we be paying attention to? What's important?
I mean, there's many things, but I think I'm going to say two things that I think are critical. One is part of an evolutionary view of culture, and the way that I understand it is recognizing the importance of worldviews, you know, and of how worldviews and these intersubjective structures, these worldviews that exist inside us but also outside us, condition our lives and the way they're built and the way we engage with in the midst of these and the way they evolve over history and over time. There's a whole science there, and it's an emerging science, and understanding that is going to help us to make sense of the confusing culture wars, the clash of civilizations, all of these things that are, we have so many different perspectives that are kind of crashing into each other in various ways right now in our kind of global commons and global civilization, that beginning to parse these out and make sense of that kind of, you know, clash of ideologies and clash of worldviews is going to be critical to make progress on a lot of the things we care about. Understanding the dynamics between them, the relationship between, we talk about modernity and postmodernity and more traditional culture and the Lexus and the olive tree and all these things. Understanding the evolutionary dynamics between these worldviews is critical to making political progress, and that's part of what the think tank we're interested in forming is going to try to bring light to. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing I would say is that, and as other people have expressed, it's not just me certainly, but I think, you know, beginning to develop more robust forms of global involvement and global governments. Obviously, as we complexify in this globalizing world, you know, we're, as many evolutionaries have pointed out, we are way beyond any kind of governance that can be really effective in certain things at a local or national level, and we have to begin to think about how we organize ourselves globally much more powerfully, much more robustly. And of course, it's already happening. It's happening because you know, life conditions are demanding it. But it, you know, it doesn't mean that we're going to just have, you know, we're going to invest all authority in one global government. I don't mean that at all. But we're going to have to figure out how to. You know, I think an evolutionary party that's worth its weight in gold and worth its salt is going to have to get serious about thinking about how we govern ourselves in the issues that affect us globally, and there's so many of them now.
Great. Well, I want to take one more live question, Carter, before we have to finish up. And this is from Tom Boogsty in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, Terry. I was thinking in the spirit of evolution, I'll share something that I find helpful in explaining to people how to bring together our everyday lives with our evolutionary lives with our spiritual lives. And what I've come up with is that our everyday life is really can be conceptualized as our mortal life, where we're dealing with issues of life and death. But our evolutionary life takes us beyond that into our immortal life, which means that every action we take, every thought we have, has a contribution to the future of humanity, the future of evolution, to build upon. And then finally, our eternal life captures that spiritual domain of the ground of being or non-dual realizations. And if we see ourselves as having all three of these existences at once and bring ourselves into a oneness with that in an integral way, we then have the ability to see that we are participating on all those levels at all times. And therefore, we can use these higher levels of evolution and the ground of being the spiritual potential of all to be able to take our mortal life and our actions and how we are performing every day to much higher levels that gives a future for humanity, I think.
Thank you, Tom. You care to comment on that in response, Carter?
It sounded like a beautiful way to speak about our life and our contribution. I don't think I have anything to add to it.
Well, thanks, Tom. I really loved what you had to say, and I appreciate that.
Thanks.
Before we complete the interview portion, though, Carter, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to one more question. Several people wrote in asking about other books, and three that were mentioned that I'd like to bring up to you is Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature.
Yes.
And that was brought to us by Lisa Norton from Chicago. And then Marcia Perryman in Hastings, Ontario, has just been reading The Adventure of Consciousness by Sri Aurobindo and Richard Dawkins, The Eye of the Eye. And she's kind of intermingling her evolutionary journey with those two authors' perspectives. And any comments on the array of perspectives those three books bring forward?
Well, all of that sounds good. I mean, that sounds that's great. People are reading. I mean, I think one of the beautiful things we realize when we embrace these evolutionary perspective is there are, you know, everything we need to know we didn't learn in kindergarten. You know, there are a lot of things we need to know, and that new ideas out there, and they matter, and they're powerful, and they're transforming, and they're not just, you know, sometimes we get ideas get dismissed too much in postmodern culture, and some of the richest ideas are in those great evolutionary pioneers. And I would encourage people to read, even though it's difficult. You know, some of the evolutionary pioneers like Teilhard and Aurobindo, they're hard to read. But get together with two or three people and read them, read back and forth and discuss them. That's when they come alive, when you can read them and discuss them. And then I promise you, if you take some of those, you know, great pioneers and really make a commitment, you will be rewarded, and because there's some beautiful, beautiful pieces and beautiful books and beautiful perspectives. And of course there's many contemporary ones too, which you can read about in the book.
Yes. And it's easier reading, and the density of epiphanies that you're going to get by reading Carter's book is just tremendous. You know, I don't feel like we're done at all, Carter, but we certainly are done based on the clock. So
okay,
I want to tell everybody what's coming next week and give us a chance to open up the lines and hear each other's voices to say goodbye.
What a pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. Well, stay on to say goodbye to everybody, for sure. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. Just forward the email that you got announcing this with just a few words to some of your friends. People can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested to learn more about Carter, definitely buy and read Evolutionaries, Unlocking the Spiritual and Cultural Potential of Science's Greatest Idea, and visit carterphipps.com. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to look at the Integral Community Seminar and the remarkable year-long training I'll be doing with Thomas Hubel, the website for which will be going up in just a few days, and also to sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter at terrypatton.com. Now, in 2 weeks, on July 15th, we're going to really wade into this political issue in a whole richer way, because I'll be talking with somebody who's been working full-time in Washington, D.C. He's kind of an inside-the-beltway political attorney who's been very active, but from a very enlightened perspective. And right now, his project, although he does come from you might say he's more of a Democrat than a Republican, he is interested in transpartisanship and works with people from both sides of the aisle. And he's using the principles of natural healing to break partisan gridlock. And so he's going to be offering a rare message of hope. The title of our dialogue will be The Innate Natural Intelligence of the Body Politic. On August 5th, I'll be talking with writer, retreat leader, and Episcopal priest who's been helping to reinvigorate Christian mystical practice, the Reverend Dr. Cynthia Bourgeot. On August 26th, integral evolutionary philosopher Steve McIntosh. On September 23rd, the wet, hot, and wild American yogi Shyam Dodge. On October 14th, Gonzo journalist Daniel Pinchbeck. And then later this year, I'll be talking with trauma pioneer Peter Levine and Buddhist eco-philosopher Joanna Macy. So thank you all so much for joining Carter and me today. Let's open up the line so we can, those of us at least on the phone, can hear each other's voices and say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye. 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 Bye.